And then you add in things like the GOP tax plan. These tax cuts just, went into play and screwed people, for example, in California and potentially here who have wildfire problems. But they help these corporations receive more money in their pockets in the future that they are using now to buy more of their shares. And all of it has been connected to these policies of basically infusing the system with cheap money and allowing it to artificially stimulate the markets. That's not an inherently stable system.
That's Nomi Prince, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Nomi Prince on the inherently unstable economy. We hear a lot about bulls and bears and the magic of the stock market. The magic is shared by a few. The richest 10% own 84% of all shares of stock. Remember the days when Republicans prided themselves on being fiscally responsible? Well, they're long gone. The deficit and the debt are astronomical. The 2008 crash ushered in the deepest recession since the Great Depression. Can it happen again? You bet. Just read the tea leaves. The tax cut just blew a gigantic hole in the budget. The big banks are now sitting on record profits. CEOs are giving themselves huge bonuses. Draining the swamp? The economy is led by ex-bankers and Goldman Sachs alumni with the same mentality that led to the previous crash. And there are few checks and balances as deregulators rule government agencies. Our guest today is Nomi Prince. She's a former Wall Street investment banker turned journalist. Her articles appear in major newspapers and magazines. She's the author of It Takes a Pillage, All the President's Bankers, and Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. She spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at an event organized by the Lannan Foundation. And now, Nomi Prince.
I was on Wall Street when the financial crisis was being concocted. I was at Bear Stearns when the euro was created in 1999, and at the time we were having conversations about how we could trade around it and which kind of customers we could get in and out of, what types of transactions that could benefit from the new currency. And one of the things I did back then, when I started to have some negative thoughts about the industry of which I had been a part since I was 19, since I started at Chase, was that it was starting to collapse the world. So even in the late 1990s, we had an Asian crisis. We had a Russian and Eastern European crisis. There was problems manifesting throughout the world that were a result of the things that banks were doing with respect to pushing debt and different types of transactions and securities on to less informed and less capable of repaying that debt countries. It wasn't the first time there were collapses from a crisis standpoint in the late 90s, but it was the first time I was involved in sort of the other side of that. And one of the things that I actually mentioned to some students at Santa Fe Community College is that the uniqueness of being there in banking at Bear Stearns and going to something which was a huge demonstration in a city called Birmingham in the United Kingdom. And in Birmingham, many people from around Europe were coming and joining together to participate in a demonstration that was called Jubilee 2000. So this was way back, and the idea of Jubilee 2000 was that people should realize that the debt incurred upon countries that could not afford to repay it by banks and governments that could, and that had the wherewithal to achieve funds to repay debt if they took it on, but pushed it on other countries, was something that was unsustainable. And so there I was working as, at the time, a senior managing director at Bear Stearns, and sort of having all these thoughts about how unright this was in terms of some of the things that we were doing. And we were pretty small, Bear Stearns in London, in the scheme of what J.P. Morgan was doing, what Goldman Sachs was doing at the time, and so forth. But it just didn't make a lot of sense. So I took off on a Friday to go on a weekend to drive up to Birmingham. And I was in a church before the demonstration, and there was a woman there named Ann Pettifor. She's a brilliant economist, very progressive. Now she's one of the people, among many of the other things that she's done in her lifetime, advises Parliament on issues that relate to actual real populism and real economics and foundational economics. But by the time I was a young banker and she was just someone who was speaking at a church, and she'd come back from Africa where there was a lot of problems. She had traversed through Africa, and she was just talking about the sort of devastation and the poverty on the ground, and a lot of it at the hands of sort of financial complex transactions that various governments had taken their own cuts of and then sort of imposed upon the people in their various countries. And she started to talk about these stories, and she started to just cry, you know. And I'm sitting there in this church, and you know, I got to go back to my day job at the bank on Monday, and it just kind of struck a real chord. And years later, actually this year, I realized that she was going to be speaking in London on some of these issues with a now colleague of mine, Jim Rickards, who I write with, who wrote a book called Currency Wars and different things about the monetary system. He's more on the right side, she's more on the left, but it doesn't matter because the monetary system doesn't care about political affiliation. You know, the elites don't really care who you vote for. It really doesn't matter. What matters is the policies that get instilled in the back of that. But I wrote to her and I said, you know, almost 20 years later, I was in this church, you know, at Jubilee 2000 in Birmingham, and I saw you, and like, oh my God, you're now sort of talking with a colleague of mine, and this is kind of the trajectory of where life has taken me, has taken the world, because on a lot of many elements, the world is so much less stable than it was in 1999. The debt that's been incurred upon these countries is so much worse than it was at the time, and nothing has really changed. In fact, in many instances, it has become significantly worse. But yet, there you are, and there I am, and I just want to tell you that what you said to those people in that church before 1.5 million of us or so were holding hands around Birmingham and talking about canceling this debt, which didn't happen, that really struck a chord, and I just want to thank you. And she was very sweet, and we're now Twitter pals and everything else. So there's a lot of things that have changed for me, but a lot of things that have stayed the same in terms of how the sort of elite deal with the rest of the world. When I first worked at Lehman Brothers, so this is before 99, I first worked at Lehman Brothers in the early 90s. Lehman Brothers no longer exists. Of course, Bear Stearns, where I worked for in London in 1999, also no longer exists. So I've got two out of four banks that I worked for that no longer exist. So I was a junior sort of analyst on the futures and options desk at Lehman Brothers in the early 90s. And the things that we did back then were sort of the nascent financial engineering elements of what became derivatives, of what became toxic assets, of what ultimately imploded the financial system in 2008. But back then, they were sort of simpler. And one of the things that was going on was I was writing the analytics and programming, the math behind some of these products. And then there were salespeople on the trading desk that would go out to different customers and say, hey, if you buy these products, you'll do really well. We'll do really well. Everybody will be happy, and you'll make a lot of money. My job was to basically create, again, the math for this. And I started to get into this fight with the salesperson because I thought he was kind of brutish. And he also used to take a lot of credit for stuff I was doing, and that just didn't sit well with me because it's like, look, you know, you do your thing, you're good at selling, I do my thing, I'm good at math. And we should at the very least sort of honor that about each other. And we started having these like major fights, like literal fights on the trading floor. And at Lehman Brothers, the way the trading floor physically looked was that it was like a big space of lots of different sort of desks with, at the time, Bloomberg terminals. So Michael Bloomberg's like invention before he became mayor of New York and so forth. It was they were on everything. And then there were screens on the top. So every time the Federal Reserve said something or Alan Greenspan said something, it was up there, and we'd stand around and watch it. And then all around the side of this room were glass offices, and in the glass offices were all of the managers of the firm. They stayed close to the trading areas of the firm, with the areas that made the most money. And so one of the people that ran the firm at the time, Dick Fuld, who ran it the whole time through the financial crisis, was kind of there with the sort of people under him, and they're sort of watching me fight with the salesperson. I mean, we're not fighting, we're not, you know, punching each other, but I mean, there were words. And so management decided, because they were interested in this product that we had developed, that we should go on the road together. You know, either A, I was going to come back, he was going to, you know, something was going to happen, but we should do that. So they set up a series of meetings with central banks in Asia. So it wasn't like even going around the world to like London. It was going around the world to Malaysia and to Singapore and to the Philippines just to see what would sort of happen with the product and with us. So we did that. And one of the places, we stopped in Malaysia first. We went on to the Philippines. And then we went on to China. And so I actually met with the People's Bank of China back before there were mostly, you know, many international hotels in China, back when it was not part of sort of the superpower community that it is today and that's become over the years. It was still sort of in a nascent thing. So there I am sitting with a salesperson and a bunch of bankers from the Central Bank of China talking about this product from Lehman. And I'm also a vegetarian as a whole separate other thing. And one of the things that they served us at one of the dinners was drunken prawns. And I don't know if you know, it's tragic. They stick live prawns in a boiling pot, and then they turn it up, and then the prawns start moving around, and then they eat them. And no disrespect to anyone who likes that sort of thing, but it was kind of like, so I'm sitting there dealing with the prawns and the bank and the sky, and trying to sell a product called termed TED spreads, which all that meant was we were trying as a bank to get our treasury bonds that we get from effectively through the Fed from the United States government, trying to sell those bonds to the People's Bank of China. And a lot of banks sell to them. They don't get them directly from the government. They get them through different investment banks who are called primary dealers from the government. And these primary dealers compete with each other to sell those treasury securities to central banks or to other types of customers. So the product we had developed at Lehman was kind of providing a way to have them buy the treasury bonds from us, from Lehman Brothers, as well as a couple of other derivatives in the mix from which we could also make money. So the idea was to explain this to them mathematically, have them buy more treasury bonds from us, and sort of call it a day. Anyway, so this trip lasted a few weeks. One of the things we did in China was go see the Great Wall of China, because, you know, as you do when you're there. And at the time, again, it was very different from what it was when I went back last summer. There were no buses. There were no, like, massive amounts of tourists from everywhere else. There was, like, this old woman selling these silk scarves that she had made, and it was very cold. And, you know, there was, like, three of us there from Lehman Brothers one morning, and we were the tour. That's changed significantly as things have opened up. Markets have opened up, and everything has changed. When I went back into China, it was a very different place. And I sat in meetings with people from the IMF in China and the Asian Development Bank and all sorts of other individuals who were coming together to figure out how to open the markets even more in order to be more part of the international community and to be more part of leading the world in terms of its currency and other things. And this was a direct manifestation of markets becoming more global, but also policies that had been set in place in the wake of our financial crisis of 2008. So when 2008 happened, it was because our banks like now J.P. Morgan Chase, Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, which don't exist anymore, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and so forth, were Citigroup, were creating toxic assets or manufacturing new securities out of subprime loans. That's a kind of old story at this point. But I just want to explain a little bit of it because it relates to where we are today and how the same stuff is going on just on a broader scale and just kind of in more secret at the same time. Toxic assets or securitized stuff, whether it is securitized subprime mortgages or corporate loans or debt or toll road payments or wine receipts, doesn't matter. But the idea is that you are sticking a bunch of stuff into a larger security, and it's supposed to pay interest. And based on how much interest it pays into that security, the security is then cut up into other pieces, and it itself pays interest to the investors or the buyers of those pieces. And there is something called a waterfall or hierarchy about those pieces called tranches. And there's no reason for them to be called tranches except it sounded French and cool, and that's what the street decided to call them. They're pieces. They're slices of a larger security. And the idea is that you have kind of an order. And if you buy what's considered to be the purest piece, the piece that's going to get its interest payments first and therefore pay the investors their interest payments first for buying it, that's a higher rated piece. That's a AAA piece. You start to go down the slices or the tranches of that security, you get to the bottom at something called an equity tranche. And the reason it's called an equity tranche or an equity piece is because it will not pay out anything until all of the other payments have gone out to all the other different investors that have bought all of the different slices of this larger security. The problem is, if no interest payments are going into the security, or if there is fraud about the amount of interest payments going into the security, nothing comes out. So nobody gets paid. And ultimately, 60 to 70% of the worst assets that were created during the financial crisis by the major banks, who then sold them on to different countries and different municipalities and pension funds and so forth, weren't paying anything. That's why the financial crisis happened, because what happens when banks aren't able to receive from each other the payments that they bought and sold on some of these securities in the process of selling them elsewhere, they start to close their doors. They either close their doors sort of forever and companies go bankrupt, like Bear Stearns, which almost did, but instead got sold to J.P. Morgan Chase, and Lehman Brothers, which just kind of dissipated. But otherwise, these institutions stopped trusting each other, and the system collapsed. And what happened in the wake of that collapse was both a political and a monetary solution to the collapse and to fix what was called the systemic, or the emergency systemic problem of the financial system, which was to infuse these banks with money. They weren't getting money. So not only did we, as a government, bail them out, which was a small portion of the sort of subsidies they received, the largest banks, but also our main central bank, the Federal Reserve, got involved in manufacturing money in order to repay them. So rather than, say, fixing some of these assets, some of these actual mortgages that made up these securities, and actually, which would have been a far cheaper solution, and we wouldn't be anywhere near the situation of instability that we're actually in today, they decided to instead infuse these same banks with more money. I was just in Vegas, and I went to play blackjack, as you do, and I sometimes forget the stuff I say about how you should perceive certain situations. So I know when I talk to investors or I sort of write pieces that the right thing to do, the sane, stable, logical, preserving thing to do, is to have a sense for, if you do make money, to get out and not continue to bet. And if you're losing money, not to continue to put more in. I mean, these are just things that we should all do in life. So I'm at the blackjack table with a friend, and it's always bad to sort of team up. It's really better to do these things on your own. Who has no philosophy. It was just like sort of putting money down and losing it. And I was very sanguine about the whole thing because I understand blackjack. One of the reasons I actually was accepted by some of the Bear Stearns men at the time, in the 90s, when I was like the only woman working there, certainly only person with a title and running a department ultimately, was that I beat all of them in a game called Liar's Poker. So one of the first things I had to do in London was be in like a seedy pub with all these guys from like all of these sort of places. Bear Stearns was kind of considered the Wild West of finance, particularly in London, and basically be there, you know, not late, but intensely, because the pubs close at 12, winning their money, and that was kind of how I was accepted. So I do understand that there's a certain element towards leaving when you need to leave. I didn't do that. I just forgot. I put down $100 on blackjack, and I was up 30, and you should walk away. And I didn't. And I, you know, my friend went through like 100 like in nanoseconds. I kind of stayed around. I looked at cards. But I wasn't sort of concentrating on that sort of exit strategy. And I wound up losing it. And I wound up having a conversation on it in my mind and saying, you know, what I didn't do is I didn't consider an exit strategy for inflating my position at the blackjack table. Like, I should have left. And I should have played, if I wanted to, with the house's money. You know, pocket the $100, come out, play with the $30. You win, you lose, but you're not taking it from your pocket at that point, and it becomes your sort of excess capital at that point. But you're not borrowing it from someone else. You're not taking it from your own pocket. You're kind of walking out with a strategy in place. And so I went back and did that. I said, okay, let me just, for my own edification, for my own sanity, I'm going to go back to the blackjack table. I'm going to do this. And this does not mean that I know I'm going to win in blackjack or not. It's not the point. The point is that I had an exit strategy. If I lose this much, I leave. If I win this much, I leave. And I went back, and I took $50 at this point, because again, you shouldn't take the other 100 at this point, because I lost the 100. So I took 50, and I made 20, and then I left. So I'm like, okay, this is actually how it should go. It is not about absolutes. It is about percentages. Now, what happened in the wake of the financial crisis with respect to private banks from the central banks is nothing like that. What has happened in the last 10 years, and starting in 2008, is that the Federal Reserve led all of the other major central banks to infuse their private banking system with a lot of money. How do they do this? By a strategy called quantitative easing, which is like calling something a tranche. I mean, it's just an overly complicated term. Quantitative easing. It's you're giving them money and you're buying stuff from them in return to make it look like you're having an equal exchange. You're not. You're basically buying either treasury bonds back from these private banks, who, as I mentioned to you, are basically in the center of the Treasury Department and where they sell those treasury bonds to anyway. So it's you're creating a triangle where the Federal Reserve effectively buys treasury bonds. Starting, it's one of the elements of quantitative easing, the first round, bought treasury bonds from the banks that got them from the Treasury Department and gave them back to the Fed, and the Fed gave them cash. So it's a closed triangle where basically the U.S. issues debt and the banks get money. I mean, that's what it is. So they started doing this with treasury bonds, and the reason it's easing is because if you buy treasury bonds, the price of them goes up. If anyone buys them, right? If anybody buys anything and there's enough demand for it, the old sort of classic economics or just sort of psychology is that, you know, the price will go up. In bond math, if the price goes up, the rate goes down. And that was how the Fed not only kept rates down from engineering rates down, from saying the Fed funds rate, the rate that banks pay each other to borrow money, we are going to keep calibrating downward to zero, which they did. But in order to keep it there, we're also going to give them money, buy bonds, have the price of the bonds go up, have the rates go down, and that's going to just be an additional sort of downward pressure on rates. And then they didn't just buy treasury bonds from these banks, they also bought their crappy mortgage bonds. So the 30 or 35% of mortgage bonds that didn't sort of combust are hanging out at some of these banks, or they're hanging out as composites of other pieces of mortgage bonds at some of these banks, and nobody's buying them because they're crap. So the Fed decides to buy them. So what that does is it doesn't just give the banks who were holding them more cash in return for the Fed taking those bonds. It also means that because there was demand, even though it was the Fed who was demanding these bonds, they can reprice upward all the other crap they have on their books. It's true, right? I mean, if you have a garage sale and you put all your like crappy couches and like old TVs and, you know, chipped mugs and stuff in one place, and someone's like, oh, I got this really cool chip mug, it's awesome, I just paid $100 for it, then you're going to mark up your next chip mug. You're not going to be like, well, it's only actually worth 50 cents. You're just not going to. So, and that's exactly what banks did. They're like, okay, the Fed altogether collectively bought $4.5 trillion worth of bonds from the banks. Trillion. So the GDP of the United States now is just under $20 trillion. So that's like, you know, 25% of GDP equivalent. But it's also an even higher percentage of the assets that the big six banks are and were holding. It's about 60 to 65% equivalent to the assets that the top six banks are holding. So it's a lot of cash to be infused into banks in order to get crappy bonds or even treasury bonds. But that's the current status of the Fed's book. So they did this in three steps, QE1, QE2, and QE3, over the few years after the financial crisis. Now, there's different things they could have done instead with that money. They could have, for example, helped to fortify the mortgages of people who had been screwed by the banks. They could have decided to, you know, build better highways. They could have decided to, you know, have high-speed trains like they do in China and Japan that actually work and are awesome. They could have, I'm from California. I live partly in LA and in a town called Ojai, which was affected by the Thomas Fire in December. I evacuated the first night from the fire, you know, and it's not like the Fed's money could have kept the fire from occurring, but the Fed's money could have, or in general, conceptually, prevented the damage that the mudslides incurred upon surrounding towns after the fire, because there would have been actual funding to create sustainable methods of keeping slides down when the rains came, which was an inevitable sort of seasonal thing. It's something that's happened in New Mexico as well. I mean, there's things that money could have been used or set aside for rather than simply buying these crappy bonds or buying debt that otherwise would not have been needed from the Treasury Department, and it was not needed because it never got used, right? I mean, it is sitting in the Fed's books. This is debt that hasn't gotten used, plus mortgage bonds that were created. Other things could have been done with that money. They weren't. And it wasn't just the Fed that was doing this. What happened was the Fed decided to sustain our financial system in this manner. But it also was like, well, it's a global world. These financial markets are interlocked. These banks are interdependent. They trade with each other. They're investors borrow from them significantly to then go and buy other assets, stocks, bonds, and so forth. Like, we can't just have one country try to monitor its rates and buy bonds from its banks to keep rates down and money into these banks. We have to make this global. And so what the Fed did was it got the European Central Bank involved, and it got the Bank of Japan involved, and Switzerland, and it basically said, look, we need this to happen collectively. Now, these banks didn't necessarily face the same initial crises that the U.S. faced, because for the most part, it was our banks that screwed up the entire world. It really wasn't the other banks. The other banks were a part of it, but they didn't have the same impact because they hadn't been manufacturing the toxic assets in the amounts that our banks manufactured them and sold them on to the rest of the world. They were just sort of, to some extent, bystanders, not so much the biggest European banks like Deutsche Bank or UBS, a Swiss bank, but for the most part, we're not as involved. And yet their central banks had to basically play along in the same game of buying bonds from their banks and corporate bonds from their larger companies who are customers of these banks. And in the case of Japan, equity share products from their institutions in order to maintain an upward movement of all of the market. So collectively, the major central banks in the world didn't just manufacture the $4.5 trillion that the Fed manufactured to go into our banking system instead of going into anything real. They manufactured almost $22 trillion. So now you're talking about, and they are still holding the assets, the bonds that they bought with this money they manufactured on their books. And this is just the G7 central banks.
You're listening to Nomi Prince on the Inherently Unstable Economy. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So it's effectively taken a decade of this process to continue, and it's still continuing, to really manifest what's an artificial market. So we look at the stock market, which is, you know, roaring up at historic highs, going from 24, 25, 26,000, and so forth. And we have a president who's taking credit for that. And not that the last president didn't also take credit. I mean, this finance is completely bipartisan. It really doesn't matter what whoever's in power says. There are legislation issues that do matter. But from the standpoint of money in, money out, it really doesn't make a difference. The capital doesn't care. And so what's happened in the last year is what had been happening over the last 10 years, which is that markets have been bolstered by this central bank money that's gone into the private banks, that's gone into the major speculators, and that has lifted all these asset classes up to make up for the fact that rates are, on average, 0% for these banks. So in order to keep that entire global 0%, if the Fed starts to raise its rates, which it did for the first time by 25 basis points at the end of 2015, and then several times in 2016, three times last year, they've raised them a bit from zero. But other banks have lowered theirs or grown their quantitative easing measures. So the net result globally, collaboratively or collusively, is that we maintain this system where central banks are effectively lifting these markets. And then you add in things like the GOP tax plan. And what does that do? It enables companies who have been spending the last number of years buying their own stock with cheap money because they get to borrow at cheaper rates because, A, rates are down everywhere, and, B, their sort of bank mentors are working with them to create this debt because then they make money. They're effectively continuing now with an additional tax cut to buy more of their shares. So this isn't like they are actually paying people more or they are creating more jobs or creating more infrastructure or anything like that. And they've said this. They've admitted this. This is all sort of public knowledge. They are simply buying their own shares with this additional, and they will be with additional money they don't even have yet. These tax cuts just went into play and screwed people, for example, in California and potentially here who have wildfire problems. But they help these corporations receive more money in their pockets in the future that they are using now to buy more of their shares. And all of it has been connected to these policies of basically infusing the system with cheap money and allowing it to artificially stimulate the markets. That's not an inherently stable system. That's a system by which any mistake, any raising of a rate by too much too quickly, any actual what they call tapering or reducing the size of that $21.7 trillion that's sort of lifting or acting as a concrete foundation for the markets and for the banks in those markets would have, any sort of alteration too quickly could unravel all of what's happened in the last 10 years. And when they unravel debt markets first. They unravel the companies that borrowed money and borrowed too much relative to what they were able to bring in, the countries that borrow too much money, the countries that borrow too much money in dollars, as the dollar has been declining in the wake of all of these sort of bizarre policies, and ultimately defaults or the inability to repay this debt starts to become the norm. It's not really there yet, because they're sitting there trying to figure out how not to make that happen. I went and I addressed the Fed a few years ago, and the topic was, it was the Fed, the IMF, and the World Bank. And the topic at the time was how to sort of induce the banks to be responsible to the main economy. The question was actually, why isn't Wall Street helping Main Street? That was sort of the question of our close thing. So I'm at the room in the Fed where the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee that sets rates and decides on some of these policies, meets. Janet Yellen spoke, and a number of all central bankers are there from around the world, and they're all skeptical of what's going on because they understand, and generally the outside world understands some of the instability that this sort of policy has brought into the rest of the world. And right before I spoke, there was a cardinal that spoke. And he had just basically met with the Pope, and he was going around the world talking about how it's important to remember the poor. So he talks right before me. He didn't talk about finance. I mean, he's a cardinal. He talked about the idea of not incurring usury rates on people, of understanding sort of the plight of those less fortunate, of just remembering the poor. I mean, that was what his talk was about. Everybody sort of nodding. And then he finished speaking, and I spoke after him. But I started by saying, so you create a policy whereby you provide trillions of dollars of cash for like nothing, for chipped mugs, right? You provide cash to a system, and you require absolutely nothing in return for that cash. You don't require an extra amount of small business loans to be given. You don't require an extra amount. All this money goes to the biggest national, international banks. You don't require more infrastructure funding on a local level or on a state level or on even a minor interstate level. You require absolutely nothing. And you're sitting here having this bizarre question session as to why Wall Street's not helping. Why would they? Which is what I said. There's no reason why someone who is receiving money, you know, you're Jamie Dimon, you're running J.P. Morgan Chase, you have all of these opinions about how banks shouldn't even have more rules attached to them anyway because you've just made all this money. You've been gifted, my old company, Bear Stearns, years ago, you've been gifted Washington Mutual with help from the government. You're sort of happy about your lot in life. Your stock has gone from, you know, it's up 10 to 12-fold, depending on the bank, between March 2009 and when I was speaking in late 2015. You're like, you know, why would you do anything different? Like, you've won. You're at that blackjack table. You put down 100 and you made 10,000. Like, and no one asked you to take any of that. And no one required you to take any of that. No policy was made to accept a give back. And not only that, in the process, you were fined hundreds of billions of dollars for all the crimes you committed along the way. You know, J.P. Morgan Chase committed felonies. I mean, they settled on them. The top six banks in the United States settled for $160 billion worth of fines for stuff they did during the crisis and actually after the crisis, because they made out fine with all this help from the Fed and the government and so forth. He doesn't have to turn around and say anything about why he's not giving that money more so. To local, to infrastructure, to even have helped those mortgage buyers who created ultimately his windfall. That's not happening. And so in front of these central bankers, that was pretty much the theme. And after I spoke, a bunch of people from the Treasury Department spoke and said that everything was fine anyway. And I was like, and again, I'm at this point, I can't get up again. But I'm sitting at the side of the room now, and they're up. And they're like, well, yeah, but we regulated the banks. You know, we had Dodd-Frank in 2010. We came in. We regulated them. They have more capital requirements now. The system's better. There hasn't been a bank crash since the last crash. And everything's fine. And I'm like, because you just gave them a ton of money. Like, if again, you're at the blackjack table, you've lost, and someone's beside you saying, don't worry, I got this. Yeah, you could keep playing for a really long time, and you look pretty good because you're not actually losing. You're just, you know, sort of getting an electronic allocation from somewhere else. But that was the feeling back then. And to an extent, that's the message right now. Right now, and I do spend time in Washington trying to talk to people on both sides of the aisle, because, again, money doesn't have a partisan affiliation, and nor do banks. In fact, Jamie Dimon had said when Trump was elected, for example, that he thought he was going to be one-term president, and then when Trump made him head of some council that he created, he was like, well, I don't know, maybe he could be around for a while. It doesn't really matter. I thought that a better way to look at all of this, rather than having artificial stimulation, continued stimulation, and then worry, as these central banks do, who've collaboratively and collusively done this, that an exit strategy would be a problem, therefore they don't have one. They're just hoping that they can keep things up, that there won't be a big bank crash, that they were putting enough money into the system to cover up any problems that could be accumulating on the books of any of these same banks, that rather than doing that, you actually start to defer it to places that could actually do building. There was a graph out on Twitter that literally just showed all of this in one picture. It showed the stock market in the last year, but it's really a ongoing trend of the last 10 years. You don't have to know, you don't have to be an economist to realize that that's not really sustainable. You know, in terms of foundational economy, in terms of real actual growth, that especially when you know that it's being injected by artificial means, by central banks that have absolutely no responsibility to it. They don't even necessarily have to have stock in the stock market, nor do they have to worry about wages because they get paid okay. The heads of central banks are making between $400,000 to $600,000 a year, so they do okay. And then they go afterwards and they get these really cool sort of multi-million-dollar jobs at, you know, advising private equity funds. So, I mean, ultimately their financial situation is secure, but that money hasn't gone back into the economy. That's still sitting on their books even after these particular leaders leave onto other posts. So in terms of just ending on a sort of more positive note, there's a couple things that can be done. And again, both of them are things that I've been trying to talk to our congresspeople about, and you guys can help, just bother them. It's always good. Our banking system has not been reformed. It's not been restructured. We've not returned to a Glass-Steagall environment, which is something, if any of you have read any of the work I've done, I've been advocating since before I left Wall Street. What happens now is all of that artificial money, all of that extra subsidy that's going into the banking system is doing so, and it's collateralized by our deposits. So if a bank wants to buy its own stock, which Jamie Dimon announced J.P. Morgan would do to the tune of $19 billion last year, and that's just one year, they're doing it on the back of not giving it as services, let's say, or additional interest payments to its own depositors, but they're doing it because, like, they can, and no one's going to say anything about it. And that's because the depositors and the checking accounts are in the same institution as the other side of the institution, which gets to trade and gets to reformulate new toxic assets and structured products. But now they're not made out of mortgages. They're made out of all that corporate debt and all the corporate loans that have been given out cheaply over these 10 years because rates have been so low. And so the same thing will happen again when those combust. There has been no change in the way in which they operate or securities that they create, except for like the stuffing. So instead of like a cherry pie, it's a blueberry pie. It's still a pie. And so that needs to happen. Those things need to be separate, because then you get to a situation where when you play blackjack as a bank, you're playing with your own money. Then you're playing with your shareholders' money and not the implicit guarantee that the government will be there to back you because you are holding insured depositors' money of millions of people in your country and millions of people in other countries to their private banks throughout the world. So that's something that needs to happen. And also infrastructure, like things need to get built from this money. You could take $4.5 trillion of the debt that's sitting on the assets that are sitting on the Fed's book and just divert some of them into, for example, a public bank or an infrastructure bank where you can actually use that to fund real growth. And whether that is from an engineering perspective, whether that's from a research perspective, whether that is from, you know, rebuilding areas, you know, in terms of levees, in terms of like reducing, you know, mudslide danger, whatever it might be, having higher speed railways, competing with the rest of the world from that component, rather than having to quibble, which is what the current infrastructure conversation is in Washington, about whether or not $200 billion, Fed has $4.5 trillion, whether $200 billion of federal money can go into an infrastructure bill and be matched by $800 billion from states to build infrastructure. So what is being discussed by both parties, but sort of debated, is whether this $1 trillion infrastructure bill, which is less than a quarter of the amount that the Fed manufactured to buy bonds, can even be $1 trillion of federal money. It's not even being discussed at that level. It's $200 billion of federal money. That's what's being discussed. That does not grow a country. And that is something that's going on throughout the world. I mean, it's worse here because we were the country that sustained our banks with the most amount of liquidity from our central bank, and then we exported that that type of a strategy. In China, for example, they also manufacture money, and they also create a lot of debt, and they also have a top-heavy system from that perspective. But they are using it to actually build infrastructure in China, but also to create trade alliances throughout Southeast Asia and even with respect to Latin America and Mexico and countries that are sort of being excluded now from trade policy talks with the United States or just having problems politically and are basically not just trying to impose politics on them. They're trying to give them funds with which to build infrastructure throughout the world. Are there problems with China and how they do things? Yes. Are there problems with how we do things? Yes. But there is funding going on for real development. And real development creates actual jobs, and actual jobs create the manifestation of actual wages, and actual wages get used to buy things in the actual economy as opposed to being done on just sort of borrowed money, which is just then part of this whole pyramid of debt that's been created since the crisis. We could have those conversations, and those are the conversations that need to occur, and they need to occur on a regular basis. So that's what I do now. This arc that's gotten me in front of you today is part of really trying to dissect what's happened in the world even before I was involved in the financing of it, but also see where we can go from here and where, you know, sort of real solutions can be imposed that are economically intelligent, that are not even necessarily about political opinion, but that make sort of economic sense. And so hopefully every day is a sort of new day to fight for that, but that's something that can happen. I hope you are involved. It sounds like you are, in terms of knowing what's going on and learning, and just, you know, being local as well. You know, one of the things that I learned in particular after the fire, and I've been writing about it anyway in my books, is that at the end of the day, after any kind of emergency happens, you banks close in on themselves, but they're the ones who actually also are needed to, the way our system is structured, fund things. But also, you know, people close in. You know, they care about their family. They care about their local community. They care about whether, you know, the bar down the street or the restaurant that's been around for 10 or 20 years but exists month to month, and in my town in Ojai doesn't have tourists coming in because you can't breathe the air, like, what's going to happen on the next day? And so then local people have to take up some of that slack. And that's something that, you know, we can always think of, you know, so on a community local basis, whether it's from supporting local and community banks and public banks and sort of the idea that money and economics is actually, it's a people's thing. It's not something that needs to just be dictated by the individuals that gather for champagne and skiing, whatever, at Davos. They're the things that, like, we need to do, and we can do. We can do it by every decision we make every day. So with that, I just want to, again, thank you for listening and for being here and giving this evening to each other. So, thank you.
After the lecture, noted scholar Juliet Shore asked Nomi Prince a few questions.
At the end of all the president's bankers, you said, quote, it no longer matters who sits in the White House. Is Trump in the same structural position with respect to the financial sector that you argued, I think quite rightly, Obama, the Bushes, Clinton, et cetera, have been? Or is something different with Trump?
So, just financially, obviously when he campaigned, one of the things that he said was that he would not be beholden to Wall Street. And then he went and he put in a whole bunch of people from Goldman Sachs into positions of power, including Steve Mnuchin into the Treasury Secretary position. So what he did by doing that is, taking out everything else, is prove that from that respect, the people that are sort of running financial policy in the country are the same people. So in that respect, the problem that is now happening, though, is that all those people are major deregulation advocates. And so that's where it can get worse. Because right now, like Stephen, like one of the things that was in the Republican platform and in the Democratic platform was to reinstate Glass-Steagall. And actually, the wording in the Republican platform was very even more specific than it was in the Democratic platform, which is that they specifically were going to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. And the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, it's a very short act, and it basically separates into individual institutions with completely separate boards of directors and completely different capital sources, commercial banking, so deposits and savings and loans from any type of speculative banking, creating securities, mergers and acquisitions, any type of more complex operations. That was the point of it. So Steve Mnuchin, who's running the Treasury Department, very quickly told Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders over a course of Senate hearings and just publicly that's not what they meant. I was actually in a meeting when he first said that to Elizabeth Warren. I was in Washington. I was actually meeting with one of the senior people on the Finance Committee, who is a Republican, and he was also one of the members of the Republican National Committee. So I was actually in RNC headquarters meeting with him, and he came in and he was very respectful. He's like, so what is our policy? And the reason he asked me that was because in Trump's campaigning and in the RNC, it was very clear that the policy would be, or at least what was said it would be, was to reinstate Glass-Steagall. And all of a sudden, I was there that day when Steve Mnuchin is basically telling Elizabeth Warren that's not what they meant. And he was legitimately confused by this. And he said, what do you think Trump wants to do? And I'm like, he's your guy. I just think that if you look at, again, overall stability, there was a reason that was put in the platform. There was a reason that people feel that the banks got a far better deal than they did throughout the country and whoever you voted for. And there is a situation where the Fed and therefore the government is on the hook for potentially more money if this all goes even more wrong in the future. And there's a reason to assume it will, because things haven't been fixed from the last time. And that's what I said in the end of Other People's Money, the first book I wrote in 2004. I wrote about how derivatives would be a major problem. And in fact, credit derivatives and CDOs, which were part of the toxic asset thing, and they were, because they weren't regulated products. And the banking system had been deregulated as per Glass-Steagall being decimated in 1999. So Trump coming in is not doing anything different, except that some of his, in that respect, except that some, he's not pushing what was on the policy, like not once, and his people are very deregulatory. The fellows running the Fed, he's a former private equity guy. He's not really into regulating the financial system. In fact, he's been very clear about how the Fed should be positioned more to promote deregulation of the financial system, which was exactly what Alan Greenspan did when he helped to create a situation where banks could trade more derivatives with the capital of people's deposits on their books to begin with, and that didn't work out really well. So a lot of the people there, the head of the SEC, the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Board, who's also still the OMB director, Mulvaney, thought that, quote, it is a joke, and doesn't want it, and asked for no funding for it this year. So it's actually worse by the people who he's brought in, but it's not different from the standpoint of having this allegiance to Wall Street.
Yeah. I spend a lot of my time working on and worrying about climate change. Just in terms of your research and experience, how do you see the connections between the fossil fuel industry and the climate denier, the Kochs and their networks, and Wall Street?
Kind of like how Wall Street doesn't care about partisanship. It doesn't really care about what side of the climate change arguments it's on. And in fact, it will, banks will absolutely try to fund a pipeline the same day they'll open up a green investment account right now. So, for example, Goldman was advocating for the last couple of years, as were some other major banks, these new investment creations where green energy was a part of it, and they were actually investing quite heavily and getting private equity money to invest quite heavily in solar and in wind and in other types of cleaner energy and sustainable energy projects. At the same time, their largest clients continue to be Exxon and BP and so forth. So from the standpoint of, and Lloyd Blankfein was advocating pro-climate change, and when Trump got the U.S. out of the Paris Accords, one of the major bankers actually thought that was a bad idea. Or at least the banks were positioned to sort of make money out of it by investing in clean on the other side in Europe. So they don't care from that standpoint. They will figure out a way to make money on both sides of that.
What is your vision for how we could move out of this really dysfunctional relationship between finance and the economy to something that could really work for people?
Well, again, there is the idea that foundational banking. And so whether that is public banks or, working more with local banks and credit unions, particularly, you see this again in crises, going back to the fire. I actually spoke with representatives from Wells Fargo that was in the town of Ojai, as well as some of the local banks. And Wells Fargo people weren't particularly invested in anything because, they were just like an offshoot satellite office of a large institution that basically commits crimes against its check holders all the time. So, and the guy I talked to was very nice. It was just that idea that, it doesn't matter. Whereas the more local banks realize that if they don't find a way to help in an emergency or in general, so with the local businesses, then that entire local economy suffers, and then they ultimately suffer. And so it's easier to have that connection and then sort of solidify stuff on the ground. So I just think that's generally important. One of the things that is interesting about that on a global scale, for example, is as I mentioned, that's something that China and some Southeastern Asian countries are trying to do with each other, which is to take funds and put them directly into infrastructure. So even though there's artificial funds being created and there's debt being created, there's a plan for a lot of it to go and do something that has a long-term benefit. For example, on the national scale, aside from reinstating Glass-Steagall, and therefore, you know, sort of taking away some of that capital boost that we've given to these institutions, could have an infrastructure bank as well. And that infrastructure bank on a national level, by diverting some of the debt we've already been created to be the capital for that bank and not have these, like, quibbles. And this is the other conversation I have in Congress with both sides, is, like, you're quibbling over $200 billion and whether, like, you cut this and you give that and, you know, whether you... You know, all these sorts of really just stressful conversations. You know, you could have an infrastructure bank funded by debt we already have created that could actually go and allocate money to do things. That could partner with public banks at a sort of state level or a local level, and that could partner with smaller, even private banks. And you could have just a healthier tiered system rather than having all of the capital support go to the top of that system.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank for you. A wonderful...
Thank you.
That was Nomi Prince on the inherently unstable economy. She spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Nomi Prince is a former Wall Street investment banker. She's the author of Collusion, How Central Bankers Rig the World. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Barbara Ventrello and the Lannan Foundation. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
one night when I was fast asleep. You came in through the window, one promise you would keep. You went away for good, went high into the sky. And I don't think it's fair how all the angels die. Ba-ba-da-da-da-da-da.